I'm Vince McNally.
And I'm Elliot McNally.
And this is These Parts.
Each week, we take you, the listener, on a journey through small-town America.
But this week, we've taken our show across the pond for a very special episode.
Hopping from town to town.
And segment to segment.
Our travelogue details the best of one of the best trips we've ever taken. One that could only be called...
The European Spectacular. Hello, listeners, and welcome to another episode of These Parts, a very special episode of These Parts. I'm Vince McNally, with me, as always, and this time, in even more important a capacity, my brother Elliot. Elliot, what a journey we have in store for ourselves.
You were right to say that this is a very special episode, Vince, because it's something that we have never done before.
Never done before, and we are just setting out and beginning today. We're bringing you something really special. We're calling it the These Parts European Spectacular.
And that is because, as you may have guessed, we are in Europe. Usually Vince and I are traveling small town America, trying to fill out our already robust almanac, Towns and Country, the McNally Brothers Comprehensive Guide to Small Town America. But we thought, you know, in the wake of having 50 episodes, let's try something new. Let's go across the pond. Let's see how people on the other side of the world live.
Well said, Elliot. So for the next few weeks, we'll be taking our trusty RV across bridges, tunnels, various autobahns to bring you some of the more interesting towns scattered across the European landscape. The episode will be a long time in the making. Typically, we sit down in one afternoon, detail our travels from the week. This time it'll be kind of a process, won't it be, Elliot?
Yeah, so we have our route picked out, but in each town, we're going to be recording a new segment, and when we're done, we're going to compile all of them into a very special episode for you guys. We're starting off this journey in the town we're in right now.
We sure are. We're in southern England in a town called Dorfshireford.
Dorfshireford, England is a town with the highest number of fatalities for nannies, and that is fatalities that are umbrella related. Yes, you heard that right. Dorfshireford, I guess, is famous for having the most number of nannies commute by umbrella, and unfortunately, it has its certain repercussions.
In today's modern world with telephone lines and low-flying commercial jets, commuting by umbrella is particularly hazardous. But tradition is an important thing, not only to the human race, but especially here in Dorfshireford. So let's backtrack just a minute, Elliot, and do our favorite segment.
Let's put it on the map. So listeners, usually we would have you take out your commemorative Rand McNally U.S. wall map. However, for this series of episodes, you should have received in the mail, if you reply to our email blasts, a commemorative Rand McNally European wall map.
Now, to those wondering, which email blast? It's true that we send 7 to 12 emails a day, every day, and you had to respond to a very particular email around 7.5 weeks ago.
We prescribe to the shotgun email blast technique.
We think the person who said safety in numbers, I think that was Sun Tzu in The Art of War, they had it right on. And when it comes to media, especially email, we follow that in spades.
So if you did reply and you had your commemorative Rand McNally European wall map, take it out, put it on the wall. Be wary that although it has Rand McNally's name on it, it's an unsanctioned version. These are sort of newer models because Rand McNally himself refused to chart anywhere else but the United States.
A patriot to a fault, some had said. This was in the days before globalism, multiculturalism really took hold as a cultural idea. So Rand was all about the U.S. maps, but his bloodline has traveled on, traveled out, and has charted places all over the globe now.
And Vince, I think we should chart our segment in Dorfshireford, England.
Great idea, Elliot. We're doing local legends.
So local legends, obviously, is when Vince and I investigate a legend in whatever town we're in. We've done this all across the United States. We thought, wouldn't it be great to do it in an English town?
And no better candidate for such a segment than Dorfshireford. Elliot, who are we talking to and talking about in this segment?
We are actually talking to a chief an avid anti-umbrella transportation activist named Jeremy Poppins. I actually wasn't able to talk to him, Vince. This was all you. Unfortunately, I was stuck in jail for a few days because apparently the Beefeaters aren't exactly what I thought them to be. And I got into kind of a tussle.
When you approach them with a plate full of roast beef, angrily demanding that they eat it next to a microphone so you could capture beef eating audio in its natural habitat, I would say unhappy would be a very tame way to describe the reaction.
Yeah, well, I mean, I had that. I had my red paint. I thought that they were really into eating beef and being, a proponent of veganism. I didn't think this was a great message to the kids. And so I got thrown in jail. A silver lining to this was that Morrissey actually thought the same thing. So we shared a jail cell and we've been kind of kicking around ideas for our next album.
Hell yeah. Wow. That is a wow. It's serendipitous, I would say.
It is. I threw out the title Meet His Murderer. So it's like the sequel to Meet His Murder. He hasn't gotten back to me on that, but I think it's a burgeoning relationship in the works.
Very exciting. Maybe we could have him collaborate on a segment of Town Sound sometimes.
I'm sure he would love that.
But your loss was my gain, Elliot, and I got to sit down with Jeremy Poppins in sort of a one-on-one roundtable interview to get to the bottom of his stance on umbrella transportation and his family's past.
So let's listen to it.
Jeremy Poppins, thank you so much for joining me on an exclusive These Parts one-on-one interview. You've been very generous with your time already, and I can't wait to have this conversation.
Hello, Vincent. How are you doing today?
I'm doing splendidly. It's a beautiful day in England. I haven't had much chance to travel in Europe, and you've been very hospitable here in Dorfsherford.
Oh, it's really the Dorfsherford way. It's the English way, I think. And, you know, it's a beautiful day. It's a super califragilistic expialidocious day, if I do say so myself.
Well, that was fun. I'm glad I got to hear that.
Hear what?
Our listeners may be wondering, and their suspicions are well-founded, that you are part of the Poppins lineage, of which Mary being your patron matron.
Yes, Mary was my sister, and she was a nanny, and unfortunately she met her bitter end at the hand of an umbrella. And it led me to start the Umbrella Anti-Activist Association, or for short, Umbrella AAA.
The Umbrella AAA. You're doing a great service, not only to nannies, but to the people of England. The people of Dorfsherford, certainly. Talk to me a little bit about umbrella transportation. This is a traditional mode of movement for the nannying and governess professions.
Of course.
And it's fraught with its own dangers. Tell me about the history of umbrella travel and sort of the threats that you're facing today.
You know, it all started when families in London and in the wealthier parts of England needed nannies, but these nannies didn't come from affluent backgrounds, and so they needed a cheap form of transportation to get to the children, and umbrellas and magic just sort of found them. And unfortunately, as you said, the streets of England are fraught with danger. And so more and more nannies were getting hit by cars, blown away by jet engines, and it really is the sign of a changing time, I think. And unfortunately, the number of nanny fatalities is rising and rising. And we started some research to try and figure out how to pinpoint this and how to help people. And the first step was to figure out how many nannies were transporting by umbrella and how many just normal people were transporting by umbrella, and just to figure out the overlap, do you understand? So we made a Venn diagram, and it ended up being just a circle. But it was tens of thousands of pounds in research and development money, but I think it was well worth it, because we were really able to pinpoint that these nannies were the ones who were getting killed, and they needed help.
Pounds well spent indeed, Jeremy, to find out that it's nannies only. And you attributed their mode of transportation to magic. That's sort of an insider, a wink and a nod. It is the violent updrafts of cliffside England that propel nannies to their destinations, carrying them via strong gusts. Not actually magic, for those at home, right?
Well, it is and it isn't, I would say. It is the gusts, but there is a certain pep in any nanny's step that will bring them to the children who they're taken care of. And, you know, unfortunately, it's these children who are making even more nannies want to take up the umbrella and wing away. And they don't realize that if nannies keep using umbrellas as transportation, then they won't be showing up and singing songs. They'll be singing songs at these nannies' funerals.
Now, let's talk for a minute about a phenomenon, a euphemism in England called the shooting star, which is on a rainy night when your nanny is en route and she's struck by lightning, and you can see the flaming corpse traveling back to Earth.
Yes, unfortunately, this has happened on and off for several decades, and a lot of people think that this is a great way to make a wish, but it's really a wish upon a dying star. You know, if I could tell you a little story about this, one evening I saw a nanny on the verge of getting hit by lightning. As she was crossing the street, she almost got hit by a double-decker bus, and I pulled her out of the way. Actually, Morrissey wrote a song about that. I wonder what he's up to these days.
Do you wonder what the musician Morrissey is up to these days?
Yes, because he was able to write a song, you see, about the nannies and getting hit by a double-decker bus.
Sure, yeah. No, I'm familiar.
And unfortunately, when I pulled this nanny from the flaming wreckage, I had lost one of my hands. And so this has led to recently people calling me a hypocrite. And you know why? Because if you look at one of my hands, it is a hook. And do you see what this hook is made from, Vincent?
Don't tell me, Jeremy. I'm going to guess that it is the lower half of an umbrella.
Yes, very perceptive. Very perceptive, young McNally. It is the lower half, or the handle of an umbrella, that was affixed to my hand. And so now people say I'm a hypocrite for this. Unfortunately, you know, it gives me the ability to fly. It gives me magical powers, but I choose not to use them because, as Morrissey said, great power comes great responsibility.
Morrissey said that.
Yes, he did.
See, I was remembering it as a line from the Spider-Man movie. But I, now that you mention it, that might have been inspired by Morrissey.
Yes, Morrissey, you're a friendly neighborhood musician.
All right. Well, this has been very illuminating. Jeremy Poppins, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for the work that you do for Umbrella AAA. I know a few great contributors to that organization here and abroad. Famous musician, a hip-hop artist in the United States, right, is one of your major patrons?
Yes, Rihanna. She actually has had several run-ins with nannies and umbrellas, and she just does not like them one bit.
No. It's kicked off a famous feud between her and Nicki Minaj. Nicki Minaj, raised by a nanny in Trinidad and Tobago, takes exception to defaming this transportation tradition. And so they kind of had a spat over Twitter last year. What side of the conversation that Umbrella AAA and Mr. Poppins fell on?
Strictly anti-umbrella, as our name would suggest. And we've actually taken upon an ad campaign recently. We were able to hire Burgess Meredith's great-grandson. And so Burgess Meredith, you may remember, is the Penguin from the 1966 Adam West Batman. And so we thought if we tied umbrellas to the arch-villain, the Penguin, that people might want to stop using them.
Well, how's that gone so far?
Not great. Not great.
I think that sums it up better than I could ever hope to. Thank you so much, Jeremy, for your time.
Thank you. Wow, Vince, what an interesting conversation.
A delightful chat with someone who's passionate about what he thinks is right for a literally dying profession.
Vince, I had such a fun time in Dorchesterford. Unfortunately, a lot of my time was spent in prison. It seems like you had a great time. It's with a heavy heart that we leave, but I can say with certainty that we're going on to some amazing things.
Certainly, Elliot. If it were up to us, we would spend weeks and weeks in each and every one of these countries and maybe even the cities. But we want to bring you guys, in our own way, a did you know of the whole continent of Europe. And so we're jumping fast as a fiddle between European cities. And so we've got to leave Dorchesterford as quickly as we came.
Well said, Vince. Next up on our journey, we are headed to Lieberleben, Austria. Hey, listeners, it's Vincent Elliott McNally come to you again, this time in Lieberleben, Austria.
Continuing our These Parts European Spectacular, we are in the Austrian countryside in a small hamlet. It goes back a long way. It's a couple thousand years old, and the history really oozes out of every nook and cranny here.
So to start this out, hopefully you still have your commemorative Rand McNally European wall map up. We do. We actually have it affixed to, it's about half of the windshield right now. It's the only place that we could really put the map in the RV.
And to make up for driving on the other side of the street in England, we actually put it over the driver's side, which, not a lot of forethought on our part. We've had to let kind of our instincts take over when driving. It's a good thing that the RV has four-wheel drive. That's all I'll say about it.
So listeners, take out your pen, stick it in Lieberleben, Austria. Vince, why are we here today?
We are in beautiful Lieberleben, Austria because it is so historic. In fact, it was run for a long time by the same monarchical bloodline. Now, of course, as you know, sometimes purity in bloodline was a thing that monarchs in Europe thought was very important. And so the ruling family of Lieberleben, the Bonfleeps, became horribly inbred, for lack of a better word.
And so this has led to basically, or literally, everyone in Lieberleben being related. Is that true?
Yes. Well, with the, you know, global culture we live in now, there's been some diaspora and there's been some emigration. But many people are still in the Bonfleeps bloodline, and it's caused quite a distorted view of attractiveness and physical appeal.
For this town, we thought a great segment to explore would be the Weekly Where's Vince.
So as you listeners probably know, the Weekly Where's Vince is my opportunity to dive into a neighborhood in the town that we visit and get to know it more intimately. And this week in Lieberleben, I was in the Cheese District.
The Cheese District. So, Vince, do the Bonfleeps have a history with cheese?
Not at all. The Cheese District is a euphemism for the nightlife, dating, and drink-having neighborhood, kind of the downtown district of Lieberleben, named the Cheese District because everyone in the city kind of has a cheesy malodor about them. So when you go in, when you go into the clubs or the local watering holes, there's a very pungent kind of spoiled Gruyere nasality to the whole situation.
So I'm sure that everyone in the town is used to it. I know that I was, you know, I'm pretty sensitive to smell. How was it in the Cheese District?
Well, the moment that I walked into the first club, I immediately passed out. And thankfully, when a kind gentleman came over to help me, his aroma had a sort of smelling salts effect on me and woke me back up. So I ran across the street to the local CVS and bought clothespin. I put it on my nose, and then I was able to continue my journalism from there.
So I picked up a magazine earlier today, and I want to show you the cover. It's Lieberleben People's Sexiest Man of the Year, and all the runners-up just seem, I'm just going to say, it's not what we're used to, and they all live in the Cheese District. Can you describe, kind of, just like what you were seeing there?
Absolutely. The sexiest man in Lieberleben was Gael Bonfleeps, and he, of course, his family goes way back. He's a sort of a notorious playboy here in Lieberleben. I'll give you a quick rundown since this is an audio segment. You guys can't see what we're seeing on the cover of Lieberleben People. He's got a hairline that is receding, but it's receding from left to right, not from front to back. And so he's kind of balding. He's bald on his left side. It's sort of gradually more and more hair, and it ends in long, stringy locks on the right side.
This was almost a result of the first case of Lamarckian evolution, right? So the first regional monarch didn't have hair on one of the sides of his head. And so to just make him feel comfortable, everyone started shaving their heads on that side. And in a few generations, people just didn't have hair there anymore.
It's considered very fashionable here in Labor Lubin, men and women alike. He's got goblin-esque ears. They kind of taper to a point. Not in sort of a charming elfin way. The point is at the bottom of the ears.
The goblin families in Austria started inbreeding with the Bonfleeps in a couple hundred AD, right?
The Bonfleeps saw the goblins and thought this was a marked improvement to their own genetics. And so they purposefully started breeding with goblins, so the legend goes. His arms are very small. They're sort of T-Rexical in the fact that they cannot move below a 10 degree radius in either direction. So they're kind of perpetually stuck out from him, a la some sort of scarecrow. And then we'll move to the sincere and severe webbing of all appendages, not just fingers and toes, but also some underarm webbing. The Bonfleeps are known to be not very athletic, but magnificent gliders. And so they'll sometimes, in the mansions of their estates, they'll glide down to their guests from the second floor balcony.
So how did the Bonfleeps really rise to prominence, in especially in the Cheese District?
Well, the Cheese District today is where all the rich and fashionable elite of Labor Lubin live, for good reason. But it all started a long time ago when the very opportunistic first prince of the Duchy of Labor Lubin met a blind princess from Catalonia, and he saw his chance to spring into the forefront of European political power by an intermarriage. And so the very first Bonfleep would have undoubtedly masked his aroma and worn a porcelain mask to hide his double nose or abbreviated chin. The blind princess fell in love, and once the Bonfleeps were in power, power begets trend, trend begets fashion, and fashion begets practice, and the unattractive became attractive to the people of Labor Lubin.
And still to this day, are there beauty standards that are different from men and women? I mean, you described Gael, the sexiest man in Labor Lubin. What are the women like?
Well, there are some inversions of the norm. Breasts, for instance, are very popular on men, but not on women. So you'll like a man with a flabby chest, and those are usually accented by shirts with two holes near the pocketry, so the breast can sort of loop out, looking like a photograph of soup being poured. For women, the adverse is true. A muscular, flat chest is popular, and so the weightlifting community has a championship in Labor Lubin every summer because the women here are prolific weightlifters, very fit.
So did you do anything else in the Cheese District after you had regained consciousness?
I sure did. I went to see a local show. It was sort of a take-up of Kabuki theater, but instead of a mask, the performer wore a paper bag. And it had two little holes cut out for eyes. And when the performer eventually revealed his face near the end of the night, I passed out once again.
But nobody else in the audience did, right? This is pretty commonplace for everyone else in the town.
Yeah, the audience cheered wildly. It had sort of a cabaret-esque effect, kind of inspiring their collective libidos. And when they saw his snaggled teeth, multiple snaggled teeth, He kind of flashed him a smile. Spontaneous making out and dry humping began in the audience.
I am recalling the story of Gerard Bonfleep, who actually auditioned for the Rocky Dennis film, and they didn't give it to him because they just found him too terrifying, and they wanted to have all the prosthetics be artificial.
That's true. That's not the only run-in with show business that the Bonfleeps have.
Really?
The Bonfleeps family, big fans of Hollywood. The Cheese District is sort of modeled after Los Angeles nightlife. When they were going to do the Harry Truman biography pick, originally it was a Bonfleeps family member, Louis Bonfleeps, who auditioned, but they found him too attractive for the role.
Have other countries or towns, have you noticed, taken any advice from people in Lieberleben, or have any trends been started in Lieberleben even?
Certainly. Wherever there's money and power and fame, there's bound to be some trendsetters. The physical standards of Lieberleben may not be as quick to catch on, but you can see a lot of the fashion trends in Lieberleben really starting to disseminate. Originally, skinny jeans, something that are now nearly ubiquitous across the world in terms of what's fashionable and what's in. They started in Lieberleben because the Lieberleben bloodline is notoriously small-legged. Looks almost skeletal, with some very protracted knee sockets. And so they kind of walk like a stick figure might walk. They kind of waddle with straight legs around. And when they dance, they kind of hold each other's hands. They just kind of spin slowly like a weather vane. Now, the skinny jeans were a product of practical invention here in Lieberleben. But the people of Europe, soon England, then soon the United States and the world, adopted it in a matter of months.
I mean, that just goes to show that, you know, one town or country's standard of beauty, it doesn't really matter, because especially in the age we live in, people can take inspiration from anywhere.
True. Now, it should be said that the United Nations has issued a cultural quarantine on Lieberleben. You're not allowed to take pictures or video here because the hope is that other places in Europe will never see the horrors that are Lieberleben and start to look more like them.
Well, you and I got a special pass to be here. You're not actually allowed to come here. They want to contain the incestuousness of this town, but because Vince and I are journalists and we're researching, we're able to come here.
I think the border guard at the Austrian border said to us, under his breath, I do speak a little German, he said, "Oh, they're Americans, ugly enough as is okay."
Yeah, because they think everyone else is horrifyingly ugly.
It's to say nothing of Austrian beauty as a whole. But that was indeed the neighborhood I stayed in, the Cheese District. It was a great time. It was eye-opening, and it was on several occasions eye-closing.
Vince, I think we should keep this good time rolling.
I think that's a great idea. Sorry to see you go so soon, Lieberleben. We're sorry to see us go. But we've got a date in France. Hello, listeners. Back again on the next stop in these parts, European Spectacular. We've gone across the border into beautiful southern France.
If you still have your commemorative Rand McNally European wall map out, you should. Vince and I have painstakingly kept it on our windshield. We've been driving with our heads out the windows, but we still have ours up. So stick a pin in Vivre France.
Vivre France is a town that, in like many cities in France, obsessed with cuisine. The great French gift to the world, French peasant cuisine, as some of you foodies out there might know, kind of revolutionized the way that we look at meals, and simple constructions can be the most elegant.
And Vince, I think, you know, you and I have the privilege of having one of the biggest foodies as part of our traveling duo.
You're talking, of course, about yourself, Elliot.
Obviously, yes.
True or speculative as that may be, we do have a segment that's tailored to exactly this sort of town, don't we?
It's called Elliot's Eats. So, listeners, Elliot's Eats, of course you know by now, is my food journalistic take on a segment. I go to a town, I eat the same restaurant all week to really absorb the food culture, and you can read all about it in the forthcoming Chew on This, Elliot McNally's Food Guide to Small Town America. But this time, you know, we, as Vince said, we are really in the heart of culinary excellence in France.
We sure are. Now, Vivre in specific has, as some, you know, critics of the town in the food world have said, taken peasant cuisine to an inevitable extreme.
You know, when food trends start, they usually start because, you know, off the grid somewhere, someone's doing something, and as they become more and more popular and get more bound culture, people want to take this fad to an even more extreme. That's exactly what's happening in Vivre France right now, Vince.
It sure is, Elliot. Why don't we frame the conversation in terms of the restaurant that you participated in, the restaurant that you visited most frequently this week?
This week, I spent all my time at a little place, a little hole in the wall, literally, called Jean-Luc's.
Jean-Luc's is an actual arch-shaped hole in the side of a of a cathedral, and its logo is a little mouse eating a little cheese. It's cute because the hole kind of looks like the hole in the wall from like a Tom and Jerry cartoon.
If you look close to the logo, it's actually a real mouse eating a real piece of cheese. He's just always there.
His name's Pierre, and he's sort of like a beloved mascot of the town.
Yes, he's given a lot of inspiration to the dishes. Jean-Luc, the founder and head chef, is always looking to him to critique his dishes. But really, the story behind this, Vince, is Jean-Luc was a peasant in France, and he was a beggar on the street, and he would, you know, ask people for scraps of food. He would dumpster dive. All he had to his name was just a plate. He would gather everything he could get on his plate during the day, and he started realizing in the recent years, people would come up and ask him where he bought the food he had on his plate, and he would look at it and say, "What? This is just a bunch of trash. I'm just putting this on the plate." But people thought he had actually gone to a restaurant to buy all this stuff.
And so he, as the legend has it, he and Pierre conference. Pierre would always, in those days, he lived on his shoulder, sort of like an animal companion. Mm-hmm. And Pierre squeaked the idea of opening his own high-end luxe cuisine restaurant. And the rest is history.
So what happened is, he started making more money by taking all of these scraps of food and then selling them on the street than he ever did just begging for money or food. And one thing led to another, and he was able to open up the hole-in-the-wall restaurant. And as hole-in-the-walls go, they're small. There's only space available for a very finite number of seats, which obviously we all know about supply and demand. This just increased the demand, and there was always a line around the block for this place.
Absolutely. At $100 minimum a plate, speculating only to Jean-Luc's personal palate on any given night, the chef's menu is heralded as one of the most innovative. There are food critics all over the country and the world that deride Jean-Luc for his sort of lack of maybe training, artisticness, what have you. What did you think of your time at Jean-Luc's?
I thought it was fabulous. I was actually there when Alton Brown was there, and Alton just, he couldn't deal with it. He was going on and on about how this wasn't food, this wasn't anything, and it made a lot of people upset, and he was asked to leave. But I loved it. You know, being the foodie I am, and arguably I may or may not have more experience than Alton Brown, you know, I'm not speculating too much, but I was able to appreciate it for what it was, and especially Jean-Luc's most recent dish, which is on the menu, is just called Les Paysans. And what this is it's his idea of the ultimate deconstruction. And so you're familiar with deconstructed cuisine, right? You know, it's taking some sort of cuisine and assembling the parts of it on a plate.
Yes, meant to sort of showcase the ingredients themselves. They use high quality ingredients, but don't necessarily combine them.
Yes, it's the gestalt of it, the whole and the sum of the parts idea. What he wanted to do was deconstruct everything even more to the point where it doesn't exist. So you're presented with a blank plate, and you are afforded the opportunity to create your own cuisine.
Now, I wasn't in there with you. I was in the RV making sure that we didn't get towed since we were parked in front of a fire hydrant. But I saw Alton storm out with his empty plate. Of course, passersby mistook him because of his appearance to be a beggar and started to put money onto his plate.
Yeah, this just made him even more frustrated. But, you know, for the people, the patrons in the restaurant enjoying their meal, you know, you could make up whatever you wanted for the meal. And so it's almost ingenious for Jean-Luc to do, because you cannot get a bad review of a meal you have created in your mind.
A true watertight loophole, if there ever has been one. Jean-Luc, for this stunt, has made cuisine magazines the world over. Hyper deconstructionist, he calls it. Hyper deconstructeur is how he says it personally. Is that correct, Elliot?
That's correct. He's actually teaching classes right now, and he has a notorious habit of looking at whatever his students have presented to him and throwing in the garbage, wiping the plate clean, saying, "You don't need any of this stuff. You don't need it." You know, and you have to have a thick skin in order to be one of his sous chefs, really.
You literally need a thick skin, because he'll frequently beat on you with a flaccid rolling pin.
Well, and if you carry, let's say, a stew or, you know, a hot chili over to him, you better believe he's going to knock that right in your face. So you have to develop, or you will develop, a thick skin learning all about the déconstruite cuisine.
Wow, Elliot. So besides the les peasants, were there any other dishes that you got a chance to sample while you were there? You were there for a whole week.
I was. Well, I didn't live there, but I was there enough to live there. And actually, Jean-Luc lives there. You basically sit next to his bed. So it's kind of like you're getting a home-cooked meal regardless, which is really nice. I did have the opportunity to sample a couple of Pierre's dishes. And these were just sort of scraps that the little mouse had found on the street. But again, people just go nuts over this stuff. You know, they think actually he might be opening his own restaurant. There may be even a friendly rivalry developing between Jean-Luc and Pierre.
Did you get to try Tres Fromages?
Well, yeah, I did. Yep. That's just, it's the same cheese, actually. That's what a lot of people don't know, but he's just taken three small bites of it and then assembled them on a plate.
Wow. Artistry in its truly minimalist form. Fascinating. Elliot, any closing thoughts on the food scene here?
My closing thought is I want to see where it goes next. You know, we've seen the deconstructed cuisine. We've seen the hyper deconstructed cuisine. What's next? You don't even get a plate? I cannot wait to see where the culinary minds take us. And I know it's going to be right here in Vivre France.
Truly. I think the world is excited to see, or not see, the next great achievement of Pierre and Jean-Luc. And I'm excited to see the next stop in our journey, Elliot. I know we're already leaving Vivre too soon, but c'est la vie, as the French would say.
And que sera sera, because we are going to the next town right now, Vince. Listeners, buongiorno from Italy. Vince and I are continuing our These Parts European Spectacular in another amazing town.
We sure are. We're in northern Italy, just south of the Alps. And what a town. What a beautiful town. What a historic town. Listeners, if you want to take out if you don't already have it out, comprehensive Rand McNally European wall map, we've, for the sake of safety, visited a glass cutter while we were in Andorra, and they removed half of our windshield, and then we fastened it with some curdled sheep's milk to the side of the RV. So we've kind of, the map is fastened to the windshield, but now the windshield is fastened to the side of the RV.
They adorned the inside of the RV with an elaborate mirror system. So now we can look, and through the mirrors, it will let us see the side view of the windshield, which then will let us see the road.
Some might say needlessly convoluted. Some might not be of the inventive mind, Elliot.
That's true, Vince. Especially when you're talking about the town we're in today, it is really the biggest fans of invention, I think. It's a town called Leonardo Fino, Italy.
Leonardo Fino, Italy, a town fascinated with ingenuity, a town full of problem solvers, and of course, a town that reveres famed Italian artist and inventor Leonardo da Vinci.
So Leonardo Fino is an interesting town because although da Vinci wasn't from here, all these people from the town really admired him. And who wouldn't? You know, he was a great guy. He historically didn't ever visit the town because he knew how many weirdo super fans he had here. But in recent years, they have decided to honor da Vinci by maintaining his even lesser known inventions and just incorporating them into their lives to show the world that this brilliant man is still very applicable today.
So well said, Elliot. So true. We all know of Leonardo's great works. Some of his inventions are used in everyday life to this day. And he's kind of a great father of practical engineering. But Leonardo Fino is such big fans that they have kind of scoured the lesser known works of Leonardo da Vinci and live out their practical use in day-to-day life today.
As you know, da Vinci had notebooks upon notebooks of drawings, inventions, everything. Leonardo Fino has collected all these just to see how influential da Vinci, even posthumously, could be.
Certainly, Elliot. And the results have been truly astounding. Why don't we look at just how prevalent Leonardo's work is here in Leonardo Fino in a segment we call Giving Them the Business.
Giving Them the Business is a segment where Vince and I look into the smaller business and the economy of whatever town we're in, the mom and pop shops of the town we're in, because really that's what these parts is about. It's about towns being sustained by people who live in them, and what better segment to do so than giving them the business.
Absolutely, Elliot. Now, where were we this week? We went to several businesses, all based around the propagation, the modernization of da Vinci works. Let's talk about the first one. I think perhaps the most intriguing of them all.
I think so too. Of course, da Vinci is very well recognized for his different sorts of machines of conveyance, right? And so one amazing shop that we ventured into was called VelociVinci. And these are all of his bicycle and flying machine contraptions that you can buy and you can use today. Vince, I actually bought one and I brought it here. I thought we could demonstrate it. It's called the Vitruva Cycle. And so what this is, listeners, is if you imagine just a giant wrought iron wheel about, I guess, 5 3/4 feet in diameter. And Vincent, here's hop on here with me. So I'm going to stand in a T shape in the center, and then you stand behind me sort of like spread eagle. Okay, so are you in position?
Give me a minute, Elliot. It's been a while.
It's just, it involves some core strength, but once you're there.
All right, I've got it. I'm balancing.
Okay, so now we're right behind each other, and now we can go and rotate in this wheel and see how this is working. Then we can just go wherever we want to in this Vitruva cycle.
I'm starting to feel pretty ill here, Elliot.
Well, okay, so let's stop before we roll down this hill. But if we just get out, you can kind of admire this thing from a distance. It's very simple, but as a mode of transportation, it is very unique and very efficient.
I am admiring it from a distance as it rolls away down the hill here. I hope that wasn't too expensive, Elliot. It seems to be disintegrating as it goes.
It was, I don't really know the conversion rate of euros, but is the dollar stronger now? Is the euro stronger?
I don't think so. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because we got to experience the same sort of joy of discovery that Leonardo da Vinci himself did so many years ago. Interesting to see his contraptions, his flying machines, and his bicycles of sorts. Why don't we investigate maybe his more day-to-day inside the home inventions?
Yeah, so what I noticed about these types of inventions, Vince, I don't know if you noticed this, but a lot of da Vinci's inventions, of course, I'm not saying that they're not fantastic. I'm not discrediting him at all, but some of them are just so commonplace today, and it seems, I was at the Da Vinci Museum in town, that he almost just augmented them with colorful language. Like we saw this one household item called the Craftapulous Fonjapulous writing contraption, and it's just a pen. You know, if I'm being generous, it's a pen with an Italian flag on it.
Though, how did you describe it, Elliot?
It's the Craftapulous Fongiapulous writing contraption.
I'll stick to the contraption for short. But yes, it appears to be a simple pen with another pen tied to it with string.
Apparently, this is like if you wanted to write two things at once. I don't really know the thinking behind it.
Except the one pen is tied reverse.
Oh, so that's if you want to, if someone holds a piece of paper above where you're writing,
then you would be able to write at sure as fast. Yes.
I don't know about how you feel about it, but just adding the word contraption to something, I'm going to be expecting a lot. You know, I'm going to be expecting a Vitruva cycle, some bicycle machine with wings on it, not exactly two pens tied together.
But who are we to critique the man's genius? He not only built an empire, but, you know, built an entire town's worth of various inventions. As far as household items go, I'm partial to the clothes slapper.
What's the clothes slapper? I didn't see that one.
It's meant to be a sort of spiritual predecessor to the automated dryer. Instead of wringing the clothes out, as they did at the time, this functioned under the understanding that slapping the clothes repeatedly would beat the water out of them.
This had it. This was the one with the giant hand, wasn't it?
It is. It is two giant hands, sort of on a dynamo, and you power this by doing smaller slapping motions in the interior of a giant wheel.
So they say, and I was reading just about this because I find this man so interesting, that he actually had a dog named Gromito. And he and his dog would kind of just sit around all day, noodle on inventions, and make these crazy things. Da Vinci had this one other household thing just to get you a bowl of cereal in the morning. And there's a marble that rolls down a track, and then a boot kicks something else, and it pours milk. It's an amazing invention.
Yes, that is still on display. It's called the Amazing Cereal Getter Contraption.
It's claimed several lives.
It's not without its perils. And it occurs to me, Elliot, that maybe inventing was a strong suit of Mr. Da Vinci's, but naming those inventions might not have been.
No, not. I mean, if you're adding weird flourishy words like contraption to things, or if you're just calling things very basically what they are, you almost need somebody else, a partner in the business, to help you out naming things, I would think.
It seems that way. I think we'd be remiss not to talk about my favorite store we went to this week.
What was that?
It's called Leonardo Yes We Did. And it's a boutique fashion outlet. It pioneers Da Vinci's work in the clothing design realm. Namely, it sports his famous headwear-eyewear combination. That is, of course, the bandana blindfold thing that you put over your eyes, but the two holes are cut in it so you can see through them.
So this was made popular by certain bandits of, you know, the Western era, right?
Yes, though some astute viewers might know them for popularization among the American TV cartoon Ninja Turtles. Now, Leonardo's favorite color is blue, so shades of cyan are on display here in force. You can pick up your unblindfold, as they call them these days, and they'll tailor it directly to your head size. And I gotta say, I love mine.
He actually tested all of his inventions on turtles first.
That's where the idea for the show came from.
You know, in his heyday, he'd have hundreds of turtles. Some of them would be riding bicycles. Some of them would be trying to use these pens that are tied together. And some of them would have little bandanas on. But he thought that the turtle, in his research, was the closest linked to the human.
A biologist he was not. He kind of viewed nature through the lens of an engineer. And he thought, hey, humans and turtles both walk and breathe and move. Meh, close enough.
It's said that actually the Mona Lisa was based on a turtle.
Yes. Mona in Italian, of course, is tortoise. And so Tortoise Lisa, kind of some thought the bewitching color scheme was reminiscent of a turtle shell. Not the case. Leonardo was just a very bad painter of portraits.
So this has been such an amazing experience in this town. It's almost like a blast from the past, really, when you're walking around.
It sure is. To see people struggling to even move a few feet of distance because of their wildly complicated moving machines, and to see people frequently bumping into things because the blindfolds are on backwards, it's quite the scene.
But this blast from the past, I think, Vince, unfortunately has to end as we move towards the future.
Even though we've loved our time here in Leonardo Fino, we've got to move on to the next stop in our European spectacular. Hello, listeners. Welcome back again to our next stop on the These Parts European Spectacular.
Today, we are in the Netherlands. You may have never heard of it before. We didn't before we got here. We had to consult our commemorative Rand McNally European wall map, which hopefully you still have out.
Yeah, did you know that some places call this place Holland?
Really? Why would it have two names? That's nonsensical. If I am a McNally, I would say that a place should have one name and one name alone. That is one of the tenets of Rand McNally.
Well said, Elliot. Maybe call us stuck in our ways, but it's the American way, and we're proud of it.
We're proud to be here today, too. Listeners, stick a pin in Vermeklindam in the Netherlands. This town is quite the sight, and Vince and I, although we had a fun time, we were kind of walking on eggshells all week.
Certainly, Elliot. As you listeners probably know, some that are more familiar with the Netherlands than we were, it's a progressive nation. They're very forward about drug taboos, sex taboos. They're a freewheeling society, and they value personal expression and individualism, to which they are lent a lot of respect from the international community. Now, Vermeklindam in particular has sort of bought into that idea a little more thoroughly.
So they are pretty avid to support the what they're deeming as the de-taboification of very mild cultural nuances here. So we thought it would be great to investigate that in a segment called You Can't Do That Here.
We're kind of turning You Can't Do That Here on its head. Typically, we investigate the laws, the bylaws, the legal statutes that are sort of unique, things that you might need to keep in mind when you're visiting a town so you don't get thrown in the clink. But this week, we're investigating some things that the locals are saying very avidly that should not be taboo, that should not be illegal.
So usually Vince and I, you know, we run into something that we really shouldn't be doing in a town that we're in. This week, as I mentioned, it was pretty hard because even just very socially normal niceties that Vince and I, being American, will do will not fly in Vermeklindam.
Certainly. I think, first and foremost, a cultural phenomenon here that I want to investigate is that of cutsies.
Vince, what is the main tenet here that you should respect about cutsies?
Well, in case you're not familiar, cutsies is when you cut in front of someone in line at a supermarket or a ticket vendor. Mm-hmm. Any number of line-based gatherings can be victim to cutsies. Now, across the globe, cutsies is kind of frowned upon because it disrespects the timeliness of the arrival pattern. Now, the people in Vermeklindam, however, have no time for anti-cutsie sentiment.
Yeah, so if you are in line for the movie, for instance, and you're waiting for some friends, they're not going to care. If your friends come and cut them in line, you know, they're just thinking, we're all going to get to the movie at the same time. However, Vince, I do know that they are pretty adamant about backsies.
Yeah, they view backsies as sort of a slavish behavior to what they call the tyrant of time, and that human beings should be able to operate independently of what quote unquote the zeitgeist thinks you should do in a line. And they view cutting backward in line as sort of a kowtowing to tradition. Mm-hmm. So what ends up happening in Vermeklindam is you sort of have an endlessly churning line with people continuously cutting in front of one another. And so your natural movement will be like towards the back of the line, and then you'll cut forward, and then you'll keep moving backward. Self-regulating, some might call it.
You know that the ultimate yardstick with which to measure a taboo is when someone doesn't mention the action anymore, right? But because they are very averse to backsies, people still have to say cutsies, no backsies when they get into line, even though people aren't going to care about the cutsies, but they do still care about the backsies.
So what you'll hear is kind of an endless chorus of cutsies, no backsies, over and over and over again until you reach your destination.
Yeah, so people really are avidly opposed to backsies, and they're hoping that in the next 3 to 5 years, that's kind of their plan, that people will understand that you're not supposed to do backsies, so they won't have to say cutsies, no backsies anymore, thus making cutsies not a taboo anymore.
Truly a cultural struggle. Elliot, were there any taboos or soon-to-be extinct taboos that you encountered in particular that kind of opened your eyes?
I did. I was walking down the street and I saw a child with his mom, and the child was crying, and it was because his shoes were untied. And rather than, you know, kneeling down, helping him tie his shoes, the mom just kept walking, like, you're on your own. And I went over to try and help the kid tie his shoes, and several people stopped me and just said, no, do not do that. And I thought that was very strange, but then I realized there were kids without their parents with their shoes untied all over the city. So apparently it's just normal life to make your kid kind of do things on their own.
Wow, a strict, some might say strict, but others might say tough love way of child rearing. They've got to learn sometime. It's an interesting phenomenon. One that I noticed, Elliot, was what would happen after someone sneezed.
So no one says bless you?
No, no bless yous, no gesundheits, no common courtesies like that. Instead, the reaction is wildly varied, but mostly involves someone coming up very close to you face to face and demanding you sneeze again.
So did you ever encounter this, Vince? Yeah, I know you had a little cold while we were here.
I sure did, and I have tulip allergies besides, so the Hollander countryside has really set me off on a sneezing fit. Locals would come up to me, they'd stand very close to me, they'd say, sneeze again. You must sneeze again. And luckily, my allergies were irritated to the point where I could sneeze one or two more times and appease them. But I was startled, to say the least.
You know, something else that I was startled by, and I don't want us to become this show, you know, we're more highbrow than that, but it's something that happened in the bathroom.
Oh my, Elliot, to what are you referencing?
So I'm sure you'll realize this, maybe some of our female listeners won't, but in the men's room, it's very commonplace to leave a one urinal breath in between you and whoever else is there.
Provided there's room that is indeed the common courtesy, so to speak, the world over.
In Vermeckelndam, you line up one after the other. The urinals are actually numbered, and you go in there, and you just have to go right next to the gentleman next to you.
Indeed, some people, in the name of progress, have begun forcibly sharing a urinal with someone already urinating in it. Did you experience that, Elliot?
I didn't, actually. I was at a place where they have gone the opposite way, because, of course, there are multiple ways of dealing with some taboos. So sometimes people are just piling into urinals almost like a trough at a baseball stadium, but in one urinal. But sometimes people who originally had, let's say, three urinals in their bathroom are just taking out that middle one. So now there is no option to go next to someone.
Truly, Elliot, this is what progress looks like. Some other important de-taboos that are being worked on. Of course, cursing is a taboo. Foul language is frowned upon in many cultures and customs. Not so here in Vermeckelndam. Children's programs here are required by law to have at least a quota of curse words or unseemly language.
It was really weird that their version of Sesame Street here, we were watching it one day just because it was on the TV when we were eating breakfast, and there were some words that I wouldn't be comfortable saying, let alone comfortable having a kid see or say.
Their version of Sesame Street is, of course, this live camera footage constantly streaming of a man actually lying on the street drunk, shouting obscenities at passersby.
Yeah, it's downtown. It's on Sesame Street, actually, in Vermeclan Bam.
It's actually called, it's called Says to Me Street because of the various offensive things that the man will say to you, the walker.
But it's in the red light district. And again, it's just like the not tying kids' shoes. It's trying to get these kids grown up early enough so they can face the world, taboo or not.
Elliot, it's been enlightening, and it's been a very inspiring week here in Vermeclan Dam. Any closing thoughts on what life is like here for the average person, or maybe to the tourists who might be visiting?
I would just say to anyone visiting, throw caution to the wind and really do the opposite of your inclination in any circumstance, and it'll probably be better suited in the end.
Well said, Elliot. And it's again with a low-hanging head and a heavy heart that we leave Vermeclan Dam so soon. But you know, as the Vermeclan Dammer would say, don't you dare say hello or goodbye to me, you filthy tourist.
So with that, we say, go fuck yourselves, Vermeclan Dam. Listeners, our journey is coming to a close in the final town we're in. And if you still have your commemorative Rand McNally European wall maps up, hopefully you do, you can stick a pin in America, Estonia.
Yes, America, Estonia, a fitting final stop on our European spectacular journey. These parts is about to board a military plane back to the United States, only aircraft large enough to hold their RV. Xander had a few choice words to say about us not renting a vehicle while we are here. That's not the These Parts way. We bring our RV everywhere.
And Vince, I think there's no better fitting town for us to end in because it's almost like a little slice of home here.
It sure is. America is a town kind of, in a lovingly said way, obsessed with American culture. The local prince here still has a vestigial monarch from earlier days who's still very influential and famous here in America. He loves American culture. Elliot, they don't have access to a whole lot of Western media here, do they?
No, it takes a while for Western culture and media and the waves of it to undulate on over to these parts in Estonia. And so they're a little behind the times, but it's almost charming to see. The Estonian prince, he actually gains all of his knowledge from Friends. I mean, what better iconic American sitcom to base your town off of, right?
Absolutely. Still receiving the propaganda transmissions from West Berlin. America, Estonia, is kind of in a constant state of consuming syndicated Friends episodes.
To appease this prince, to make him feel like he's really at home, all of the citizens are, I don't want to say forced, but
encouraged.
Encouraged, yeah, that would be a better word, to act American. So they're, you know, unlike a lot of countries that don't afford their citizens the access to Western culture, these citizens can watch all they want, consume as much as they want, all this media, just to make the prince feel like he is an American citizen.
It's really a fascinating culture here in America. Yeah. And I think a great way to investigate the nuances of this culture are through a favorite segment of ours, No Gifts, Ands, or Buts.
So, listeners, No Gifts, Ands, or Buts is Vince and my souvenir segment. What more American thing to do than pick up a souvenir from wherever we end up?
Absolutely. Now, we'll exchange souvenirs with one another, unbeknownst as to their contents before we open them, and we use it as a lens to investigate some of the trends, the culture, the behaviors of locals here in the city.
So, Vince, what do you say? Should we open these up?
Yeah, I can't wait, Elliot.
Okay, do you mind if I open mine first? I'm really excited.
Please do, please do. I'm excited to see you open it.
So, I'm opening the paper right now. I'm taking out this, and it looks like, is this a little duck?
Yes, that would be a miniature duck.
So what's the story behind this?
Now, the story behind the miniature duck, the people of America, through way of their famous prince, believe the duck to be the national animal of the United States of America.
Does this have anything to do with Chandler and Joey?
It has everything to do with Chandler and Joey, Elliot.
Okay.
Duck and the, eventually that became the duck and the chick in the season 5 of Friends, are...
They haven't gotten that far yet here, though, right?
No, they sort of have and they sort of haven't. The episodes aren't being shown in any logical order, so they sort of have a smattering from across the seasons of Friends. But the Duck and the Chick live with Joey and Chandler in season 5, and they're sort of like their pets. They're cute little patron animals. They view the Chick as a representation of Canada, and the Duck and the Chick is sort of America and Canada's partnership on a global level.
So is this like a symbol of good luck to put on your mantle?
Yes, it's a symbol of good luck. It's a symbol of stewardship. When a host has a guest, the guest will bring a duck-related item because they're presenting, because the duck is leadership, American leadership, and so the host is the leader of the gathering, and so they bring various duck-related... Now, I've seen whole taxidermied ducks. I've seen Mighty Ducks paraphernalia. I've seen videotapes of children playing Duck Duck Goose. All of these things can be sold at various duck-related souvenir shops. I went with a timeless classic, the ceramic duck.
Well, I love it. Thanks so much. Would you say that this was merely inspired by watching Friends episode, or is this allegory what they truly think Friends is trying to say by the Chick and the Duck?
The prevailing wisdom in this city is that Friends is not a sitcom per se, but more of a high drama, political state issued message. In Estonia, they don't really have any entertainment television to speak of. All of the television is state-issued propaganda, and so they assume the same is true of the United States.
Well, they do have entertainment, though, at one of several Central Perk coffee shop locations around the town.
Coffee is a massive import here. They spend 80% of the town's yearly budget on importing coffee from only New York City. They love the name Central Perk, obviously, from its title of the coffee shop in Friends. They aren't exactly certain where the pun comes from, though, as it's never explained in the show. They, of course, think, as they pronounce it, Zentral Perk is kind of the name of a famous military figure in America, General Zentral, and they're mistaken, but that doesn't make them love the coffee shop any less.
You'll see a lot of posters of sort of artist interpretations of General Zentral with stars and stripes, the whole works.
Looks remarkably like Gunther from Central Perk's staff.
Do the people of America really want Gunther and Rachel to end up together?
The people of America are convinced that Gunther and Rachel do end up together, in fact. The final episode is never aired, and so the prince has taken it upon himself to recreate a self-acted finale to the series. Some might speculate because he is doughy and balding that he might have a horse in this proverbial race. But in the final episode, the Gunther character, played by Prince Franz, as he's renamed himself, gets approached by Rachel, played by Estonian supermodel Mika Zerlikova, and Rachel proposes to him.
And it's at this point where Chandler storms in, played by Russian male ballerina Zenko Milichenko, and professes his love to the Rachel character because they haven't seen the episode here where Chandler and Monica get together.
True. And then in the episode, Joey's character, played by Estonian insult comic Hugo Bilmokova, storms in and starts singing this national anthem of Estonia and proclaiming how much better than Russia Estonia is over a 45-minute ballad.
The show ends with just on-screen text thanking the, some would say, the seventh friend, the city of New York.
Sure does. It's a riveting viewing experience, and it's projected on the side of America's only skyscraper, a four-story replica of the Empire State Building, every Thursday evening.
They've replicated it based on several Takens that Friends uses in the intro. It's right next to the water fountain, which American residents are permitted to dance in between the hours of 5 and 6 on Saturdays and Wednesdays.
I hope you enjoyed my gift, and I am
chomping
at the bit to open yours.
Please do.
Here, I'm removing the paper here. Oh my, Elliot, you shouldn't have.
I did.
You really shouldn't have. It's a two-part gift. The first being a giant oversized mug. And inside that mug is a cassette tape. And it's labeled, and I haven't listened to it yet, but I'm hopeful, the greatest hits of the Remembrance.
The Remembrance are actually, for you listeners don't know, a cover band of the Rembrandts, and it's just people who remember the Rembrandts.
That's exactly right. The Rembrandts are a band here in America. They cover all the Rembrandts' most famous works in a traditional Estonian folk music style.
If anyone who has listened to the Friends theme song know that it's full of idioms and vernacular that probably Estonians aren't that familiar with. So the Remembrance version of the Rembrance song is very much more politically involved, trying to translate, so no one told you life was gonna be this way. You know, it goes on to talk about life being stuck in second gear, whereas the Remembrance version is all about no one telling you life would be amazing in Estonia under the amazing prince that we have.
Yes, the lyrics instead go, nobody told you life was going to be this way when you always feel like you're stuck in gulag. It hasn't been your day, your week, your month, or even your entire suffrage of the working man.
And then America will be there for you. Only America. Only America. Do not ever think anyone else will be there for you. So, Vince, people think that the giant oversized coffee mug, you know, normal Americans drink so much coffee, and they think this is kind of like a novelty, tongue-in-cheek thing. Like they know that the Friends are drinking normal-sized coffee mugs, but they think that when they show that in Friends, that's just a nod to real American culture who has people drinking out of gigantic coffee mugs.
It's a bit of they have a sort of like a reverse psychology themselves into an understanding. It certainly beats the Prince's own theory, though, that Americans are just very small.
Yeah, they think the cup, like outside of Central Perk on the sign, is a representation of New York City itself, and that, you know, it's so big and Americans are very small and they're just part of that cup.
The Great Melting Cup is how we're often described as in the international community. And I think no truer representation of that ideal exists than here in America, Estonia.
And it's an ideal that I think we can take and we can bring back with us to America to look at our next 50 towns with fresh new eyes.
Absolutely, Elliot. Should we, for old time's sake, give a very European spectacular wish you were here to our listeners?
I think we should.
So, listeners, we would have loved to have you along on this months-long trip across Europe. That just wasn't feasible. We had a hard enough time carrying all the gasoline as it was. But the next best thing is a portmanteau postcard patched together from across this great continent. It goes a little something like this. Dear listeners, wish you were here along with us on our journey across Europe.
Where we stopped at a town with the highest umbrella-related fatalities.
A trip where we visited a little pocket of the past where people don't exactly look like you think they might.
In a town where we looked toward the future of cuisine.
A trip where we visited a town obsessed with Leonardo da Vinci.
Or a town obsessed with making things that are taboo not taboo anymore.
And finally, a town that's love for America rivals even my brother and my own.
We will be there for you. And farewell from these parts to yours. Hey, listeners, thanks for joining us on the European Spectacular, but we have a lot more in store for you.
Absolutely. We're looking forward to season 2 as we visit 50 more towns across this great country. You won't want to miss them. Thanks for listening, and thanks for joining us.